From the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Ben Ponce, and this is On Target.
I'm Gari Mangala, and today on Target, we'll be talking about a campus-wide conversation about the Garth Waite photo and a new Senate policy.
Then I'll sit down with Assistant Professor of Music Theory, Bill O'Hara, to talk about an online hybrid course he taught last summer. Stay with us. All right, let's go ahead and get into the news this week. Gari, why don't we start with a campus conversation that happened on Thursday of this week in light of the Bob Garth Waite incident. First, can you give the Reader's Digest version of what happened with Bob Garth Waite and then the context of this conversation?
Yeah, Reader's Digest real quick. So the long and short of it is that Bob Garth Waite, a now former member of the Board of Trustees and also the namesake for the Garth Waite Leadership Center at Gettysburg, it was recently found two students, Cameron Sowers and Hannah Labowitz, class of 21, found a yearbook picture from the Spectrum 1980 edition of Bob Garth Waite among four other, what we suspect to be other Crow brothers at the time, in Nazi garb. We now know that it was a party and that the theme of the party was a Hogan's Heroes party. And Bob Garth Waite, after the photo is found, stepped down from the Board of Trustees. It is unclear right now about whether or not the GLC will stay named after Garth Waite. I think that's pretty much the long and short of it.
The Board of Trustees has appointed a committee to examine renaming of things. And of course, the specific instance is this matter, but it will theoretically develop guidelines for use in the future.
Yeah, so earlier last week, JMR sent out an email to the campus community to attend a conversation that would be hosted by a panel of three faculty members. And it was held last Thursday at 11:30 in Mara Auditorium. And students, professors, administration all joined in to the conversation. There was standing room only in the auditorium with overflow in an adjoining room with our Facebook Live playing, and started with JMR speaking, and she also announced about this committee. Essentially, it was found that there is no protocol for renaming buildings or organizations or anything like that at Gettysburg, so that's part of the reason that they're forming this, but mostly it is for the Bob Garth Waite situation. And then it was handed over to Steve Gimbel, Scott Hancock, and Dina Lowy. And they gave their remarks. Gimbel spoke about, you know, being a Jewish person and being able to take certain jokes and that where the line of jokes are. He talked a lot about the producers, this musical comedy, and a scene in which dancers march in a swastika, and he spoke about how that's funny. However, he didn't take this to be funny. Hancock talked about essentially things that he had spoken about with students in BSU. And he talked primarily about how this is the situation for Bob Garth Waite. You know, he may have to step down from the Board of Trustees, but in a lot of ways, he's still going a free man, talking about how, you know, he's going to still be rich no matter what, and how that's not the same situation for a lot of people of color. And Dina Lowy spoke about her experience with the news as a Jewish person and feeling as if she's being told how to feel, especially with the way that the first email from JMR was posed, how she was told, she felt as if she was being told that she had to feel upset about it.
Yeah, and just to jump in for a second, particularly for maybe radio listeners who may not be familiar with some of the acronyms that you just threw around, JMR refers to College President Janet Morgan Riggs, and BSU is the Black Student Union.
Yeah. After that, it was opened up to comments and questions, and that was moderated by Dean of Students Julie Ramsey. And it was mostly students that spoke, mostly about their experience with this news, but also a lot of students kind of extrapolated and spoke about the state of diversity at Gettysburg College today. A lot of students of color spoke about how they don't constantly feel welcomed or safe here, Students spoke about Confederate flags on campus, the use of the N-word on campus. Students advocated for a stronger education on peace and justice studies at Gettysburg. And I think most notably, Jordan Knox, a class of 21 member as well, was the last to speak. And she spoke about her experience being an African-American woman and feeling as if everything she does speaks for the larger Black community at Gettysburg, but also throughout the country, how she feels that Bob Garthwaite is being treated very much like an individual, which I think I don't think many people could argue is not the case. You know, regardless, this is a, you know, people are talking about what he did, but they're also saying like, oh, but look at what's happening to him. People are feeling in some way sorry for him. And Jordan spoke about how she doesn't think that that would be the case if it was a person of color, how that isn't the case for her, how she has to focus on how she dresses and how she speaks every day, and that she's not going to be treated like an individual. And that seemed to resonate for a lot of people in the room.
Yeah, before we move on, let's play a clip from that now.
Growing up, something my mom and my parents really enforced with me was that what you do is representation on Black people, what you do is representation on our family, and what you do affects other people. It was ingrained in me that what I did was very reflective of other people, that I could just go through my life and do things, that if I made a mistake, that that little thing could be taken, it could destroy my entire life. And I feel like that's something that is really frustrating me about the situation, is that this person, he gets to be seen as an individual who's made an individual mistake. But as a person of color in this country, anything that I could do, no matter how small, can change, ruin my entire life. I don't get to be an individual. I have to represent all the other Black people who look like me and who live on this planet and who live on this campus. And I think it's frustrating that he gets to be an individual and he gets to make mistakes and we have to feel bad for him. And I'm so sorry that, you know, maybe his life is going to change now and people are going to view him negatively. But what he did, he needs to take that into consideration. He should have thought of that before he put that costume on, before all those individuals thought about what would be a really good idea for a party and decided to take something so serious and make a joke out of that. And like everybody's been saying, that it's representation not just on him as an individual, but also on the society that we live in, the world that we live in, the way that we view and perceive these very serious situations, that we think that it's okay to just make jokes of them, that we can just laugh about those things and make those things just a joke, and they're not. And going through a lot right now, I can't really articulate all the different feelings of which I'm feeling, but I think that you need to think about what you do. And for some people on this campus, that reality is just so much more real. If you're a person of color, you are very aware of what you do. I'm very aware of what I wear in the morning. I'm very aware of how I style my hair. I'm very aware of what I say. I'm very aware of how I walk. I'm very aware of how I carry myself. I'm very aware of the words and language that I use. I'm being very aware of how I'm speaking right now, that I need to be articulate because there are white people in this room. And I can't speak the way I would naturally speak because they wouldn't understand. I am aware of that. And everyone here should be aware of that. I don't care your upbringing. I don't care what color you are. I don't care what language you speak. I don't care what country you're from. We all need to be aware of that. And there is responsibility that he needs to take for what he has done. Because those things that he's done has not made, I'm not Jewish, I'm African American, but those things had an implication on me and my friends and people who look like me and people who don't look like me. And that's something that we need to take seriously. We need to continue to have these conversations, continue to talk about these things that are serious. We can change as a person. I agree, I think we all can. But the first step that you need to take is to realize you do affect people. It hurts people, it touches people. You don't just represent yourself, you represent everybody.
And so, you know, there she was. And then after that, she was the final person to speak. What was your overall takeaway, either from what Jordan Knox said or from the event as a whole?
I really respected what Jordan said. I think that it was a very eloquent and articulate way to explain it. It was very clear that she was very emotional, but I was impressed that she was able to get her thoughts together that way. I was very uncomfortable by the way it was ended with Julie Ram. Well, not by Chaplain Largen, but by the way Julie Ramsey kind of wrapped it up. It was, I don't think it made sense to call it a perfect comment. It felt very borderline like white guilty, not really knowing what to say here kind of thing. But I also understand that they're probably, when you're uncomfortable, there's not a lot you can really say. I really like the way it ended with Kristen Largent speaking. She's the chaplain of the college, and she essentially spoke about, you know, what we did in the room that day. She's a very kind person, I would say, and I think that having her words at the end was very important also to bring some context for what we could do going forward was important. However, I do think that as a whole, I worry that it was just a place for people to air their grievances, but I'm not sure how much of that's actually going to be taken into account. A lot of the comments about diversity, this isn't the first time those comments have been made in forums like this. I heard a lot of similar comments about diversity at the listening sessions for the presidential search. So I fear that, you know, it was just another time for specifically minority students to feel like they're being heard. But I don't know if anything's going to be done with any of that.
Yeah. Before we move on, you raised a good point about Kristen Largent's comments, and I did want to play a brief portion of them as well.
I'd like to offer a few final thoughts that I think can shape the kind of honest, committed, and loving conversation that can help us move forward constructively and in solidarity with one another. And these principles come from the work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran pastor who lived in Nazi Germany. He was one of the leaders of the Confessing Church, which stood against Hitler and resisted Nazi policies. And I'm sorry to say that he was the exception in the Lutheran Church in Nazi Germany at that time. Bonhoeffer participated in a plot to assassinate Hitler, and for that he was captured, imprisoned, and ultimately hung. He wrote a small work entitled Life Together, where he shares some important ideas that foster a healthy community where all can flourish, and I think they might be relevant for us today. First, he emphasizes the importance of attending to the marginalized and vulnerable in a community. Our consideration, he says, must be particularly directed toward their inclusion. We must be wary of self-absorption, of seeing the world only through our own perspectives and not giving attention to the perspective of others. And that's the white majority, right? Particularly white men and all of us who are in the white majority on this campus. Second, he emphasizes that one of the most important services we owe each other in our community is listening to them. I know you have heard this so much today, and I hope you see how important that really is. The beginning of showing love for others, he says, is listening to them. Third, he calls us to active helpfulness, small acts of care and service that let others know they matter to us and that we are willing to take time to support their well-being. Finally, and perhaps this is the most important piece in light of our discussion today, Bonhoeffer invites us to bear with one another, sharing each other's burdens and lightening their load, especially when times are rough. In this way, they know that they're not alone and that they have some support along the journey. So my friends, family, today and in the days to come, may we be support for one another when the load is heavy. May we be light for one another when the way is dim. And may we be loyal companions to one another as we walk into tomorrow. Thank you again very much.
But to circle back to your point about it being an opportunity for folks to air grievances, and questioning whether that will result in any action, for lack of a better term, I think that, to my recollection, Bob Garthwaite's name came up rather infrequently during particularly the student comment portion of this event. Such that this episode has set off conversation, but I think it's really more importantly tapped into a broader feeling of discontent or erasure was a term that came up, particularly that came up in the context of Jewish erasure at the college. You know, and so there have been over the years numerous venues at which people have gone to microphones to share these sorts of comments. It seems to me that as we continue to have situations where there are open microphones for this and the same types of things continue to get raised, that perhaps not a whole lot happens after things are raised at this venue, these venues.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, Anna Perry, also class of 21, they made a point about how students, especially like minority students, are taught to just kind of educate. They said something pretty funny. It was, I'm not even being paid. I'm a student here. And I'm educating people every day. And I thought that that was very important. I think some students talked about how, you know, the college promotes diversity on their homepage and on, in the process of trying to get students to come here. But then the resources, or whatever you want to call it, if you want to call it resources, if you want to call it acceptance, isn't really there when you come here. And I think for a lot of minority students, it ends up being a juggle between if you're going to be loud and boisterous and if you're going to go to microphones and if you're going to join a lot of conversation groups on campus like BSU, like Asian Student Alliance, like Vietnamese Student Association, like all of these things, or if you're going to kind of just live your life and kind of ignore that part of your identity for yourself and just hope that in some ways, if you like act white and if you talk white, you know, you'll pass in some way or another. But in some ways, you're erasing that part of yourself. I think I relate more towards the latter. But I think because of the situation and because, you know, we're talking about a member of the Board of Trustees stepping down and a big name on campus, and this is a couple months until the end of President Riggs's tenure at Gettysburg, I think this is a really important opportunity for the administration and for the college to listen and try to do something about it rather than just saying, we hear you, and, you know, putting a survey out for what you want to change about the college and hoping that the next president will have heard the things that students have said. You know, the next president wasn't in that room. Juliana wasn't in the presidential search committee room. He also wasn't in the room a couple days ago. I don't know how much he's heard of it.
Yeah, I did want to circle back to something that a theme that emerged, I thought, was that the college is more interested in diversity than inclusion with respect to the Office of Diversity and Inclusion that they have on campus.
Yeah.
That, you know, to the extent that they can have numbers that support the narrative that the college is interested in diversity, and one number to that effect was that this past, the class of 2022 was the first time, I believe, that more than 20% of the incoming class were domestic students of color. But I think that clearly there's a feeling that once those, you know, once we've achieved the numbers, we're not doing anything to achieve the broader goal of a diverse and inclusive community.
Mm.
And that's something that Gene Arnold, the college's chief diversity officer, has mentioned. You know, the juxtaposition between diversity and inclusion, and it seems that more is being done on the former and on the latter. You know, we had on the fall both Anna Perry and Ivana Lopez Espinoza, who also spoke at this meeting on this podcast. We had them on this podcast in the fall, and many of the same themes that they mentioned in the fall were themes that came up on Thursday, and so it'll be, once again, we'll see where the college goes from here. I did think that one distinction between this particular forum and previous ones was there was at least one concrete suggestion for what the college ought to do to better facilitate diversity and inclusion. And that came first from Scott Hancock during the opening remarks, and then was mentioned again during the kind of open mic part of this event. And that was fully funding and or better integrating peace and justice studies across the curriculum.
Yeah.
You know, to my recollection, that is the first time we've heard a concrete programmatic suggestion at something like this put forth kind of as a, certainly no one would suggest that that's a solution, but it's a concrete step along the way beyond this kind of vague and amorphous need for more dialogue that I think often is used as a crutch, particularly by people who are incentivized to talk more about diversity than do things about diversity.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that comes from this need to talk more to increase dialogue. I think it comes from both ends. I think, you know, some of the people that are sick of educating about it also just want to increase dialogue. And I don't, it's weird to say this at a liberal arts college, but I don't know if dialogue's the answer anymore. I think at a baseline, the college understands that minority groups, marginalized communities, people of color, gay students, everything. I think they understand that people don't feel heard. I don't think that that's lost on the college and the administration. But I think at this point, saying that over and over again isn't going to do anything. Especially when we have such a, frankly, white administration, you know, maybe something like what you were saying, like a suggestion that's very concrete is the way to go now. Steve Gimbel also talked a little bit about the fact that we don't teach Hebrew at this school and talked about the path that the faculty took to allow Judaic studies, the program, into existence.
Yeah, I do want to circle back to what Steve Gimbel said, because there is a little bit of context that didn't come out at the meeting that I've spoken to some people since then. I did want to circle back to the point you made, though, that the administration is overwhelmingly white, and that's true. The only member of President's Council that is not white is Chief Diversity Officer Gene Arnold. And so, you know, a lot of the times, the point you made, I think, is spot on. I think a lot of people, and as a white guy who's relatively non-marginalized, I'll include myself in this category, I think a lot of people have reached the point where intellectually acknowledge that diversity and inclusion is an important value and has tangible and positive benefits to the whole of the campus, but struggle with what that actually practically entails from an institutional policy standpoint, as well as from a personal conduct standpoint. And so I thought that this meeting in particular, this forum in particular, was a productive and healthy dialogue towards that end. To the point about the Judaic Studies program, there was for a while Hebrew offered occasionally at the college, but in the conversations I've had, it became apparent that at the time there were not enough students interested to warrant running a section of it. And so, you know, Steve Gimbel mentioned that they needed to get an adjunct line. They couldn't get an adjunct line to teach it. You know, those decisions are rooted in, to a large extent, student interest. And so there's a policy in the provost's office that for a course to run, it needs to have 5 students. And the conversations I had have indicated that the last time it ran, they didn't get 5 students, such that, you know, the determination was made that, you know, not the best allocation of resources. The other comment about the Judaic Studies minor, currently, as of last academic year, there were exactly 0 Judaic Studies minors.
Wow. Yeah.
So take that for whatever it's worth.
Yeah, but on the flip side of that, I think
Now, let me jump in and just clarify. That number, I believe, was from the graduating senior class. That's not to say that there is no one on campus currently. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I was given a statistic that was that last year in the graduating class, there were zero Judaic studies minors.
Now, on the flip side of that, I think from what I've seen on campus, the peace and justice studies minor has been growing year to year. And part of that being that Hakeem Williams, the...
I was going to say, he certainly has invigorated that program.
Absolutely. He took over, I believe, 2 years ago.
I was going to guess the beginning of the last academic
year.
Yeah.
So he's been in charge since I've been here. And he's really...
I think he took over right when he got tenure, which would have been, the fall of your first year.
And he really, I think, has encouraged students to talk about peace and justice. He has created a peace and justice studies, like, student council of minors. And, you know, those students are all encouraged to, you know, talk about it and also encourage other students to come in. And also, the thing about interdisciplinary minors, I'm a Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies minor, which is also in the IDS category of minors. Is
interdisciplinary
that
studies.
Yeah.
I'm on a mission to help people understand abbreviations because we love to throw them around here.
We do.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
You're fine. But from my experience, they're pretty easy to fulfill. So the minors at Gettysburg are 6 classes. And if it's in the interdisciplinary, honestly, why I said the acronym is because it's a hard word to say. Interdisciplinary studies minors, it's so easy to pick and choose, especially if your major, if any of the classes fall in under there, it's so easy to get this minor. And I think for a lot of students, it's kind of cool because you're able to study in different departments. And because it's just for a minor, you're able to study in departments that you wouldn't normally study in for your major. I would not usually take 4 classes in the Arabic department, but I'm taking that for my minor. And I know for a lot of people, they wouldn't normally take classes in the education department or in the philosophy department, but for their peace and justice studies minor, they have taken a couple of classes there. And I think that promotes kind of the liberal arts educational mindset in general of wanting to, you know, have students take classes in different departments, and allowing more of these IDS programs, I think, is a great way to do that beyond the Gettysburg requirements of, like, even if you're in humanities, you need to take a science class. I think that allows for students to really pick and choose. And in today's world, I think saying that you have a minor in peace and justice studies has some sort of weight to it. I don't think that we live in a climate where the lack of peace and justice in our world can be ignored anymore. Both on our campus and in the world. And I know that for students that are a part of the minor and for Hakeem Williams, I think that they would all say that that's something that should be spread more throughout the campus as a whole.
Right. And so there were 2 suggestions, just to kind of put a button on this peace and justice discussion. There were 2 kind of differing suggestions, it seemed, at this meeting. Scott Hancock suggested fully funding a peace and justice studies institute on campus. And then a student who commented later suggested integrating peace and justice studies across the curriculum. I spoke with President Janet Morgan Riggs after, and she seemed very open to more integration across the curriculum, and then mentioned that for, you know, funding a broader academic program, such a conversation would have to come from the faculty.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, why don't we move on really quickly to a couple of other topics that have been in the news?
Yeah, so in the past couple of weeks, Student Senate has been discussing implementing an opinion to request that the college puts forth the funds and the resources to put feminine hygiene products, but the Senate has been using the name menstruation products, I believe, in the women's bathrooms in public places like Cub. Cub just got new bathrooms, so there hasn't been anything put in there, and making them free. Originally, I believe this came from Student Safety and Sustainability or from CLAC, and then it just wasn't put through from the college, so then it was brought to Senate Opinions, and the opinion just went through last week about it. I was in the opinions meeting where they talked a little bit about this, and there's conversation about whether or not
the committee meeting,
about whether or not it should be put in men's bathrooms as well to be more accessible to trans students on campus.
And that, I believe the transgender concern was why they were differing on the vocabulary.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe also that's just the term that's now started to be more used around the country regarding this, just for clarification. Like, it's a term for more inclusion. Feminine denotes that it's for women. Not always the case. Yeah, so the conversation talked a little bit about whether or not this should be in men's bathrooms. However, there was also, you know, arguments made that guys on campus, especially like straight cis men on campus, would probably think that it was a joke and vandalize these receptacles, I guess. I don't know if I completely disagree with that argument. However, people were arguing that it'd be a waste of resources. But maybe it's not the best that we are already assuming that 18 to 22-year-olds can't handle the sight of a tampon in a bathroom. Yeah, but that just went through. It's a Senate opinion. If for those who are unfamiliar, student Senate opinions are just going to mean that this is the opinion of the student body. It is not binding that the administration will have to do anything about it. But sometimes an opinion can allow for more conversation, which seems to be the theme of this podcast this week.
We particularly like talking about things. We like talking about them a little bit less, and we like doing things even less.
Snaps for that. Yeah, I agree with that.
And we like snapping a great deal. Snapping more than talking about talking, then talking about talking, then talking, then doing.
Talking about talking and then snapping in response instead of talking back to talking about talking.
Yeah.
Yeah. In other news, last week, the Vagina Monologues, which has been held yearly and helped to fund Survivors, Inc., a shelter in Gettysburg, was held. Ben, can you talk a little bit about that?
So this year is the last year that they're going to present the original Eve Ensler play, I guess you could call it, which was what has been presented and what it has the title, The Vagina Monologues. Then this year they have added this component called Our Voices, which again, and as, you know, two themes of this podcast, I suppose, today are conversation and diversity and inclusion, because it includes more diverse voices. There was a concern raised that the Ensler play is mostly the experiences of white women, and so that, you know, a more inclusive presentation was necessary. And so that was, this was, this year they presented kind of a side by side, I suppose you could say. And then in future years, they will simply be presenting Our Voices, which will be student produced monologues about various experiences associated with gender and sexuality on campus.
Yeah, I think that as time goes on, we talk more in this country about the issues of white feminism. I know that for a lot of people, when the marches, when the women's marches started, now that would be 3 years ago, 2 years ago, three?
Right on the heels of Trump's election, yeah. So winter of 2017.
So, yeah. So I think that when that started, a lot of people, while a lot of people were celebrating the marches, there was a larger and larger group of people discussing the fact that, you know, the marches and the women's marches and feminism today not representing what feminism should represent in some ways. And I think that was seen through the Vagina Monologues in some ways about white feminism and how it can be in some ways more destructive than helpful. However, I do wonder if this is just going to turn into, and I don't think it would be a bad thing, but I wonder if it's going to turn into more of just like a spoken word night for just marginalized communities in general. I don't think that that would be a bad thing, but it would definitely be very different than what the vagina monologues have been about for years. However, I think as we talk a lot more about sexuality and gender identity and a lot of that, things aren't going to fit in pretty boxes anymore, and maybe they shouldn't.
All right, I think that's going to about wrap up our news segment. We'll be right back with the Bullet Report, followed by my conversation with Bill O'Hara about a proposal currently pending before the faculty to permanently adopt as part of the Gettysburg curriculum online hybrid summer courses. Stay with us. And now it's time for the Bullet Report. On February the 24th, the women's swimming team finished 3rd of 8th at the Centennial Conference Championship. The men finished 2nd of 7 at the same event. The women's track team finished 9th of 10 at the Centennial Conference Championship, while the men finished 7th of 9. The softball team defeated Shenandoah 18-11 and then defeated Shenandoah again 9-0 on the 28th. On March the 1st, the women's basketball team lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament 82-78 to Christopher Newport, capping off their season with a berth, but not a victory in the NCAA tournament. That's all of the sports action that happened. We're flipping over to spring sports season, so baseball, softball, and lacrosse will be on the docket in future Bullet Reports, but for now, thus endeth the Bullet Report.
And we'll be right back with Bill O'Hara.
And we're thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Bill O'Hara, Assistant Professor of Music Theory in the Sunderman Conservatory of Music. Professor O'Hara, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ben.
And so why don't we start with just a little bit of personal background, how you got to Gettysburg. I know that you did some teaching at Harvard that explored, and the topic of the day for folks listening is online hybrid courses that happened last, there have been several pilots, but in particular, you taught one last summer. So just talk a little bit about kind of how you got to this point and what made you interested in doing a hybrid course for the first time last summer.
Yeah, sure. So I did my graduate work at Harvard. I did my PhD there and finished in 2017.
Did you meet the new president, by the way?
I never met him, actually. No.
Sorry.
No.
Didn't mean to interrupt, but I had to ask.
Yeah, no problem. He was around, but you know, the general counsel's office has 20 or 30 lawyers running around in it.
And they don't interact with the music grad students too frequently.
Yeah, no. No, I'll actually get to the one encounter I ever had with that office. But So while I was there at Harvard, one of the really defining experiences was I had a part-time job at the teaching center at Harvard, which is one of the things that I think probably set me on the path to, you know, a liberal arts college teaching career, but also really introduced me to a lot of different media things. This is why I try to incorporate a lot of media into my classes, because it was introduced to me in such a way at the teaching center where really engaging with 21st century technology was presented as integral to being a professor in the 21st century and teaching today's students. So one of the projects they were involved in is a pretty large initiative of online courses. There's this big nonprofit called edX that Harvard and MIT and a lot of the schools around there are involved in. They're sort of all co-founders of it. And so when it was a Harvard course, it was called HarvardX. And so I was involved in making some of those. There's actually a course called First Nights, which is a big introduction to music kind of general education course there. And so I worked on creating an online version of that, helping to produce the videos, helping to create quizzes and tests and things like that that went on. And actually, in that process, the only encounter that I ever had with the general counsel's office was that they were sticklers for copyright.
Right.
We had to really document everything. Is this is public domain, or this is used by permission, or this is from here, and things like that. So that was always a big part of the process of creating an online course, because those courses are extremely public and they're out there for anybody who wants to log in and create an account and take them. Whereas this is, you know, much more local.
Right. And so you taught a class last summer on video game music, which is a course that you've also taught in in-person form. When did you first decide that you wanted to take the in-person form online or to this hybrid setting? And what kind of challenges did that bring up, or maybe what was better about the hybrid version of it?
Yeah, good questions. So I'm not sure that I can think of exactly the moment when I decided, oh, I definitely want to be involved in this program. It's something that I had talked with, Jack Ryan and Chris Zappi about the year before when I had interviewed here, about 2 years ago at this time. I had told them about those experiences that I'd had and how they were sort of important and how I was interested in continuing to explore them. So when I had been having this conversation and going to some of the information sessions, and when Jack told me that there was a spot available, I jumped at it and just sort of said, yeah, I'll do it. I'll take the leap. As you know, the courses had to be classes that were either being taught at the time a year ago right now, or were about to be taught in the fall. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody actually did that, but they were willing to accept those since they could then be evaluated sort of just in reverse order. So as far as the process, there were a few steps to it. There was kind of number one, trying to translate the class as it was into an online form, for a condensed version. My online course was sort of 5.5 weeks. We had, I started mine a little bit later because I was going to a conference right after commencement. So we started June 1st and we went through the first week of July, but we had the 4th of July in there. So I sort of let the class go into another half week to make up for the fact that there was mm-hmm. the holiday. And if people wanted to, be with family and friends and travel, they didn't have to feel pressured that they were going to fall behind in the last week. So roughly it's sort of a 14, 15-ish week semester, translates to, 14 weeks is a little less than 3 weeks, units per week,
right,
basically, is how I sort of translated it. So there's a pretty direct translation. As far as the process of teaching the course, my class incorporated a lot of video lessons. Since I sort of already had some comfort in doing that, I was making YouTube videos of, let's say, varying production values. There are some, that I really put a lot of time into, using a lot of media examples and
right.
things like that, to try to recreate some of the things I might have done in class. Those are a lot of work, though. There are also a lot where it's me scribbling on a tablet, the kinds of things that I would be writing on the board and just kind of talking through them. So there mm-hmm. are less formal things as well. And then we supplement all of those with all the same readings that the students on campus are doing. A lot of writing. My particular approach was that we're going to do a lot of writing to make up for the fact that we have fewer actual class discussions.
Right.
And then they have video meetings and things like that. So they would speak to each other face to face for a couple of hours a week. And we used a kind of live text chat thing. And many people will probably have heard of Slack. And we used this other sort of competitor of Slack called Discord, which is just more geared towards gaming. So it kind of fit in with the whole aesthetic of the class.
Right.
But it's basically, you chat in channels sort of by topic. And I asked people to respond to one of the week's readings.
And so a few weeks ago, there was a faculty meeting at which this topic was discussed. And I wanted to just kind of go through some of the concerns that were raised and kind of get your perspective from having taught this. So
yeah.
One of the areas that was broached was the idea that you mentioned it's a 15-week semester, and this gets condensed into a 5-week course. How much time do students spend, per week, per day? Is it a full-time commitment to take this class over the summer?
It's a pretty serious commitment. The scheduling of the live portions certainly works out to the point where, we had some things where we were working around students. I think I had sometimes Wednesday night things because I had students who were doing internships or had summer jobs. So I would say that a lot of people were doing other things. This was not the only thing that they were doing in the sense of a full-time commitment. But it certainly is several orders of magnitude more than a single class during the semester is. I had the sense that they were probably working on it 2 or 3 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
at least, between, going through videos, doing readings, potentially more than 2 or 3 hours a day, I would suppose, a couple of live chats and things like that. So in terms of the workload, I don't have the exact figures, and I think the figures that were shown demonstrate that it's not a 3-to-1, they don't
right.
work three times as much, but they certainly work a lot.
And so in terms of kind of what I think a lot of people think of online learning as this very asynchronous, you know, video quiz sort of model. How would you say the structure of your course was different than that? You've kind of talked about that a little bit, but what were some of the synchronous components of it? And just get into that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah. So each week we had a couple of, we had some synchronous things in which we would, I would plan them more or less equivalently to an on-campus lesson. You know, we had a lot of things in the on-campus course where it was read this article, or sometimes I would split the class and say, you guys read this article, you read this article, and we're going to have a conversation where you teach the other side of the class what your article was. So I would replace sessions like that with, you know, our chats would go about an hour, 10 minutes, an hour and 15 minutes, roughly analogous to one on-campus class meeting. So there was that in terms of actual, you know, face-to-face communication time. The asynchronous text chat would kind of sprawl across a whole week. And then, as I mentioned, there were a lot of reading responses so that students had really a lot of sort of contact with me through their writing. I really got to stay on top of what students are thinking about the material. So in a way, it actually felt like I had a lot more direct contact with my students. I was reading their writing responses at least every other day. They were sort of responding to things. Things were set up so that a unit would take about a day and a half. And so the rough model was they would probably spend Monday, Tuesday working through one unit, Thursday, Friday working through another, and then kind of Friday, Saturday, Sunday working through the third. You know, and they can work to some degree in any order that they want. But I was reading their thoughts every other day, chatting with them a couple times a week in various formats. And so I actually felt in that way more directly connected to my students and kind of staying right on top of what are they thinking? How are they reacting? How are they progressing? Are people falling behind? Because there's really no time to fall behind when there's a course like this, which is, you know, one of the potential drawbacks, but it's something to kind of be aware of.
Yeah. And so another concept that was kind of brought up had to do with how the notion of a web-based course fits in with the idea of being a liberal arts college where, you know, we talk about discussion-based classes is such a, you know, cliched term that gets thrown around all the time. But, you know, the idea that you need to be able to engage critically with these things. And some people who have maybe had some experiences that have been negative with online learning, you know, one phrase I heard from a faculty member in a conversation afterwards was they taught an online course in grad school and they referred to it as intellectually bankrupt. And so, you know, how would you say that your course was intellectually non-bankrupt?
Intellectually non-bankrupt. yeah, so I think number one, the thing to know is that these are very different than, you know, the kinds of online courses that I was working on in grad school, you know, the hopefully the kind of online course that this faculty member was teaching. This feels like a very different experience for that. Those, you know, my experience there was, you know, the massive open online courses is, are probably a little bit bigger than this faculty member was talking about, but they really had to be sort of one size fits all. And so in terms of fitting the content to my students and really working with them very closely, this felt very much like an online or an on-campus experience in the sense that there was that sense of a very small community. We kicked things off by I asked the students to each post a little YouTube video of themselves, introducing themselves. One of the benefits that I found was that students had a lot of pre-existing relationships on campus, you know, since it's restricted to Gettysburg students who have already finished their first year. You know, I had a couple of people from the soccer team who all already knew each other. You know, you have people who have taken classes together already. There's kind of a pre-existing rapport that you build on, you know, in much the same way as an on-campus course. You get to know people gradually throughout the semester and as they have talks and you know, you get a nice kind of hangout time before the live chat starts as everybody's signing in to the video and kind of sitting there and talking about, oh, you know, what are you up to? What have you been doing? And things like that and catching up. You get really the same kind of milling around feeling. So I would say that it does feel very personal and that, you know, I put a lot of attention into trying to translate the course directly in a way that feels true to the Gettysburg experience. That it's not, you know, you can't simply put things online. There is a process of translation that goes through, and you kind of think, okay, if I, what do I want my students to get out of this? What do I want them to get out of it when we're on campus, which is a lot of direct interchange. And I tried to really make sure that they were getting the same things out of the online courses.
What would you say the level of engagement of students was in this setting as compared to during the semester? You know, on one hand, when students are only taking one course at a time, it seems like it could be a very immersive experience where you're focusing on only one thing and getting to spend a lot of, you know, intellectual time on that one thing. On the other hand, you know, it can be easier to disengage over the summer or that sort of thing. What was your sense of kind of the level of engagement?
Yeah. My sense was that the level of engagement was pretty high. Again, that's partly by necessity. There's really no time to disengage and take a couple days away or skip class or anything like that. I will say that I had one student end up dropping the class because they realized, okay, I'm not going to be able to stay with this rigorous summer schedule. But like I said, I felt much more connected to them on a day-to-day basis. Like, we built up that rapport very quickly. That sometimes takes a couple of weeks on campus as you're learning everybody's names, only seeing them, you know, a couple of times a week. You're learning people's names, you're learning about their majors and their backgrounds. And that rapport actually happened very quickly because you have such intense, you know, contact with them. So it felt very rigorous in that sense. And it also was really luxurious to sort of have that be the only thing that I was working on and the only thing that they were working on. Sort of the, you may have heard of Colorado College. There's this whole liberal arts college that basically does this on campus. They have 5-week terms or so. And I sort of saw there's definitely an attraction to that model, to be really focused on one course, one topic, exploring it from a lot of different angles, and really immersing yourself in it for 5 or 6 weeks.
Was it your sense that, I mean, I don't know, were the students that you had in this course mostly non-music majors? Or was it a mix? I guess my question where I'm going with this is, was it your sense that maybe students were more willing to kind of try something new in this vein and in the condensed summer format where it didn't take up one of their slots, so to say, during the semester?
That's a really good point. So the on-campus version actually was a pretty mixed course in terms of I had a lot of non-music majors who were taking it for an arts credit. I had a lot of upper division sort of junior and senior music majors who were taking it, you know, because they were interested in it. The summer course ended up being entirely non-majors. I didn't have any music majors or minors in there, so everyone was taking it for Gettysburg curriculum requirements. It definitely seems possible that people were sort of willing to, either willing to try something new or interested in trying something new over the summer, or perhaps since there's this direct, you know, summer follows directly from the spring semester, there could have been people who were hearing about the course and wanted to take it if they weren't able to during the spring. But I also do have the sense that there's a sort of pragmatism to the students who were taking summer courses and that they were interested in fulfilling one of their requirements during the summer, particularly because there were, you know, there were a decent number of athletes. So I do have the sense that students are interested in getting some credits in a not, in an asynchronous way. But I don't really see that as a problem. I think that if students are interested in perhaps getting one requirement done so that they have a slightly easier time when it's their sports season or something like that, or, you know, offering them another chance to make up a course, whether they had to drop a course, whether they failed a course, whether they had to take a reduced schedule. You know, at one point I was corresponding with a student who had been having health problems and saw the summer courses as a chance to catch up in a way that wouldn't ordinarily be available to them.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of different ways that the students look at it.
What was your workload as a, you know, teacher of one of these courses? You know, there was the comment at the faculty meeting that, you know, junior faculty ought to be spending their summers totally immersed in research such that, you know, they'll get tenure and then maybe it's okay to teach these online courses. You know, as a faculty member, what was your experience? You mentioned that it was kind of the only thing you were doing for those 5 weeks, but what was your sense of that?
Yeah, in the sense of intensely focusing on that, it was the primary thing that I was doing. So the workload, it ended up that I would sort of work pretty intensely at the beginning of a week, or sort of, you know, sometimes I'd start on Monday, sometimes I'd start on Sunday, kind of building out the units. There were a lot of things, you know, I already had all of the PDFs for the readings and things like that, and I had everything built out in Moodle. But a lot of it was video production, in that I would start sort of on Sunday and make some videos that students would watch on Monday, and then on Monday I'd watch a bunch of videos that they'd be watching in the middle of the week, and by Tuesday I'd wrap that up and I'd have sort of the whole week built out. So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday were pretty intense.
So you were building the course as you went.
To a great degree, yeah. I mean, I had my lecture notes, I had plans and things like that, and I knew what it was going to look like. But video production does take a little bit of time.
Right.
The idea with this was that they're not fully polished. The goal is to get the content to the students and to, you know, to give them something to watch and to engage with. So I wasn't sort of full post-production, but it still would take, you know, a few hours per unit to kind of do lecture videos. A lot of times they'd be built off of PowerPoint. But as I discovered, some of the things that are very easy on campus, like showing up and playing a YouTube video of something, takes a little bit of doing. You have to figure out how to get that into the lecture video, or you have to, you know, make separate units where it's like, all right, here's me talking for 10 minutes. Now please go to YouTube and watch this other clip and then come back and watch part two. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of thought and planning. So the beginnings of the weeks were sort of front loaded with that kind of work. I'd have live chats with the students. I think those were happening Wednesday and Friday, if I remember correctly. And then there was a fair amount of grading to stay on top of, because you really want to kind of let them start each week fresh and know, you know, your responses to what they had done in the previous week. So there was a fair amount of work. But that said, it really was only 5 weeks of the summer. Mm-hmm. So I am pretty happy with my productivity over the summer, that I was able to do a lot of other research. I spent some of that time, you know, as you're doing various stages of a research project, there are things that require more or less intellectual engagement. So, mm-hmm. for example, June was a perfect time to go through page proofs and to go through, like, you know, editors' comments and things like that, and turn around a lot of the things that I'd rather not be doing when I have free and open creative time.
Right.
So I kind of got those tasks out of the way. And then really in July and August, I was able still to get a lot done. And I will also say that now that I have all of these videos ready, you know, I wouldn't say that if I teach this course again next summer that it'll be exactly the same, but that I'll have an 80% head start and sort of right. know, oh, I really want to do a new video on this. I really want to remake this video on that. I want to change this, but I'll have this whole repository of the previous course. And so teaching it a second time will be a lot less time consuming.
What, if any, drawbacks are there to this model, or things that you wished you would have been able to do, or that you might do differently in a future iteration of this, that maybe are not as much issues in the traditional classroom setting?
Well, I will say that the technology occasionally, you know, caused a few little hiccups. I'm not sure that any of us in the this past summer really solved the video chatting issue to a way that we were all very happy with. We were kind of experimenting with different pieces of software, but one of these online courses is in an awkward spot where a lot of the free solutions that are out there, like Skype and Google Hangouts and things, sort of top out in the single digits. And so if you have a dozen students and a professor, you're kind of looking at something that we pay for.
Right.
So I think once the college decides to do this, they'll make an investment in something professional. Like there's some Adobe software that people use to teach online courses and do remote meetings. But as it was, we were a little bit patching things together. So there were some times when so-and-so's webcam isn't working and I can't see them, or they get disconnected from the video chat. So there were occasionally technical issues. I was lucky enough not to have internet access problems, but I know that that's a potentiality that I may not be able to connect, or a student may not be able to connect. And those are things you don't really worry about on campus.
Are there any pedagogical drawbacks?
I'm not sure that things flow, you know, quite as freely as when you can move around the room and kind of engage with students. You know, I do occasionally miss. There are things you learn to do as a professor that actually require you to be in person. Sort of, you can use proximity to the students. You can, you know, you can circulate around. You can sort of check on their levels of engagement and get people to think about things differently, or you can reconfigure. You know, I find a lot of value in reconfiguring my classroom for a day and getting mm-hmm. the students to pair up or something like that. So you can't really do that in certain ways online, but at the same time, you actually generally have their faces right in front of you. So you can sort of check on their level of engagement in those sorts of ways. It ends up being a little bit different. Overall, to give a broad answer, I'd say everything needs to be planned out in a way that it doesn't necessarily on campus. There's mm-hmm. there's no way to sort of fly by the seat of your pants when your lesson isn't quite there and just use your own subject matter knowledge. You kind of do have to have things planned out in advance. That, I think, in a lot of ways is a plus. It actually requires right. you to structure things and to think things through. But yeah, and like I said, you get some video chatting, you get some informal time before and after, but you actually are not physically there with the students, and you might potentially miss out on some of the before and after right. chat and things like that.
And then, were there any lessons from teaching the hybrid online version of this that you actually would bring into your traditional classroom, you know, from, you know, either pedagogically or things that you could do with the technology?
Yeah, well, I definitely made some videos that I'm going to continue to use with my on-campus students the next time I teach this. It sort of lets you know, the nice thing about having to translate a lecture into something that someone can do at home is that you can then do some sort of flipped classroom techniques, for example, where I now have a bunch of lecture videos that are delivering content, which will allow me to do a little bit more discussion the next time I teach this course on campus. They're also, you know, kind of really nicely polished, teaching videos that I put out there that, I can have my own students watch. A couple of them have even sort of made it out into the YouTube ecosystem, and I have one on theories of play that I keep getting comments from non-Gettysburg people stumble across it, and they say, "Oh, this is such a great summary. Thank you for making this." Yeah, you're welcome.
YouTube famous.
Exactly, YouTube famous. You know, it's got, since the summer, you know, not a ton, but 500 or 600 hits. You know, I should have put an ad on it and be 12 cents richer.
There you go. So on balance, it seems as if you would say that this was a positive experience that you would like to see the college continue to move mm-hmm. forward with. Based on what you've heard other faculty members saying and other comments that have been made at faculty meetings and such, what would be kind of your closing argument in that vein?
Yeah, you're right, Ben. I do think that this is definitely a positive thing. It's a chance to think about your teaching in a different way. It's a chance to... You know, you don't necessarily always get the chance to teach these general education courses back to back, for example. So I came at the course differently, having just taught it in the spring. One other thing I'll take back to campus is just the fact that it's given me another chance to reevaluate the papers and the assignments that I already have. So mm-hmm. that process of course development usually takes a few years, and this can accelerate that. Overall, I'd say that it's a very productive thing for the college to be working on. I think that they've done a couple of summers of the pilot program and we've learned a lot of things. There's still more to learn. But I think that really engaging as a college in the 21st century is going to require us to continue to experiment in these ways. And I think the opportunity right now is to do that on our own terms. By continuing to develop online courses, continuing to run them, getting more faculty involved. You know, I'm sure that there are more people who are interested who haven't yet had the chance to teach a course online, but there are also probably faculty members out there who might not think they want to do this, but would find it a really positive and productive experience. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to decide what does online or hybrid teaching and learning look like for a residential liberal arts school. And at this point, we have the freedom to experiment and decide that for ourselves. You know, if we were coming to this in 10 years, we may not have that freedom. It may be a matter of mm-hmm. we're behind. We need to think about our survival or our continued thriving. So I think it's a really exciting chance to really experiment and find the ways that feel true to Gettysburg, find the ways in which a summer program can complement all the other things that happen during the school year and during the summer. I think that it can be a very useful part of the residential experience that we offer.
All right, Professor Bill O'Hara, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank Bill O'Hara for being our featured guest today.
We would also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their ongoing support in this project. Please be sure to subscribe to On Target on TuneIn, Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, senior music major focusing on composition in the Sunderman Conservatory of Music. Be sure to join us next week. I don't know who we'll talk to. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Google Play. Have a great week.